EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments. All right, countdown's ended. Welcome back to another episode of EMS on the Mountain. As usual, Mike and Sean discussing the topic du jour. For those that don't speak French, that means, I don't know, I don't speak French either. So today we are going to talk about, holy crap, I think we're just going to call it some of the attributes of a professional responder, whether you're, I guess this would apply wilderness, urban, suburban, whatever you want to call it. But we're going to talk about various topics ranging across the spectrum. I guess we'll leave it at that. And we'll see where this thing goes. Free form. And
let's get some definitions out of the way. Professional responder does not mean paid. I have actually been putting work in. Everybody in America that's listening to this podcast, all six of you. All eight of you understand that America is still largely a volunteer-driven system. There's career providers in a lot of larger municipalities, but there's still a number of people that provide volunteer care, and that is ever-present in the wilderness arena that we specialize in talking about. So there's a lot of folks that are unpaid that do work in the space. Professional is, I guess you could almost call it adulting. Right? How do you stay engaged and do a good job for the people you've committed yourself to take care of? It does not necessarily mean you're getting paid. So if anybody heard professional and thought, oh, it's paid guys, which is largely a conversation that happens often in a lot of different places in the country, we're not talking about paid versus unpaid. We're talking about being an engaged, committed professional. And there's a lot of things you can do in an unpaid manner that you're still being a professional and acting professionally in the execution of your duty. So, got that weird clarifier out of the damn way. I have actually started trying to use the term paid versus unpaid, providers versus career versus volunteer. It's, quite frankly, I've volunteered for 20 plus years of my life, and I don't consider myself a dirty volunteer, quote unquote. I'm just as committed to performing the job as anybody else.
All right. Well, I'm a dirty volunteer. I ain't scared.
You are a dirty volunteer, but you're also a professional, Sean.
I am a professional, and I will say the two of us put in 1,200 plus hours of volunteer time. So for you folks listening, if you want to do the math, that's essentially a full part-time job.
Very much a thing that has consumed a lot of my life. And by the grace of God, my wife has been tolerant of the fact that I'm committed to doing this. All right. First off, let's talk about some aspects of a committed professional responder. And I'm going to draw a hard line here, and this is going to suck for some people. Hopefully nobody listening to our podcast is going to be overly frustrated by this statement, but I do draw the line in professionalism, whether you commit energy and effort to maintaining your skill set, or whether you go get certified and then chase CEUs and just want to make sure you get your hours in to keep your card, get your hours in with the same repetitive, this is how we splint sort of stuff, is not being a professional, but maintaining a certificate. You don't have to be an ALS provider to be committed to maintaining your skill set. There are innovations and changes and science that affects a lot of things around what is traditionally referred to as BLS or first response care. And you have to stay up to date with that stuff too. So we're not only talking about ALS providers, but it is going to feel like it has a little bit of an ALS bent because we're the ones that tend to push drugs and such. Well, that's not really true anymore either. There's a lot of drugs that BLS providers push, but
yeah.
So first and foremost, go ahead, John.
No, continue. I think what I was going to say eventually here naturally.
First and foremost, staying up to date is part of the job. Absolutely is. If you became an EMT in the late 80s, early 90s, and have never learned anything, you're still going to be looking for mass pants. And it turns out that mass pants are actually making a comeback. Mass pants in general, they went away a long time ago. And if you didn't understand the why, it's important to, if you didn't understand the why mass pants went away, then that's, I'll call it part of staying up to date. It's not just a matter of my protocol says we shouldn't do this anymore. It is part of the professional responder's responsibility to stay up to date as to why mass pants were considered non-effective intervention anymore. The other obvious example that I can use is we used to bolus the hell out of people with fluid because you got to maintain that blood pressure. And it turns out that really wasn't helping. And it was probably blowing cloud flus and stuff. So there's a lot of examples of this.
Yeah. Another big one is backboards and C-collars. The whole spinal immobilization on backboards came from one study done by one doctor a long time ago. And people just jumped on it. And then we start doing actual studies and go, this is a bad thing. And this applies to all provider levels. Backboards, I'm often still surprised we keep them around for any reason, but it is what it is.
And it is what it is.
And I think C-collars is a good example of, it's a simple thing to talk about when and when not to be using them, and we don't put everybody in them anymore and all that. But there are some things that go with C-collars that when you put them on somebody, like causing increased intracranial pressure and things like that, you need to understand the why putting the C-collar on is bad and when you might not want to choose to use one. And that's another, I think, really good example beyond just some of the other stuff, because those are still floating around trucks. Everybody's still got C-collars.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you've gotten away from full rigid backboards and you've gone to vacuum splints or scoop stretchers, C-collars are still everywhere. And you got to understand the pros and cons to when and when you wouldn't want one of those too. And
that's,
yeah, if you're just
an important aspect that I was going to mention a little later, but I'll bring up. No. On top of the science isn't the same thing as following your protocols. And there is an important distinction to be made, and there's a way, and I'm going to talk about a way to help you drive progress within your agency. This is coming from personal experience. So it's an N of one, but C-collars is a great example, right? They're in every truck in the country still. They're out there all the time. And I can tell you there are places that I work where people get wound up about the fact that I have not C-collared and backboarded somebody before we made any movement. And my response is this bewildered, are you kidding me? Like, the science is pretty clear. Plus, I happen to work in pretty aggressive places. Our protocols were updated a long time ago to remove that criteria, and yet people still do it. And I consider that the minimum baseline, right? If you're an active provider with a card and an authorization to practice, you should probably stay on top of protocol updates and such. That is a critical thing you got to keep track of. But
yeah,
there are ways to drive that change and be the change you want to see. It is not violating your protocols. That is not the way to do it. You need to... We'll talk about that in a little bit, but my point here is you've got to stay up to date on the science, and that means that we need to develop some skill sets. First off, I hope the 8 people listening are all committed to being good providers, and I will fully admit that Sean and I are, we're old hat, we're old gray beards, at least I am. Sean's not quite so gray in the beard, but it's getting there. We've been doing this a long time, and in pursuit of knowledge, you end up eventually falling into the scope of wanting to understand more of the science and the pathophysiology and what is commonly referred to as critical care level provider skill set. I'm actually coming to hate that term. It's not critical care. It's advancing your knowledge. But this still applies to folks that are not ever going to fly, that are not ever going to be doing transport. Understanding the science of how a medication works is important. Understanding the science of what's happening or why we decided to, for example, backboard or put mask pants on and what the theory was behind it, and then understanding pathophysiology to level that makes you go, huh, what's it? Makes you, that yeah. isn't necessarily, no, this doesn't make sense to me. Yeah. We should feel empowered to say this doesn't make sense to me. And hopefully you've got a medical direction structure that allows you to say, hey, let's look at the science. Hey, doc, I read this study or I saw this report and I want to talk about, can we change this? And it is incumbent upon providers to maintain that skill set, because it's not only up to the provider to just follow the rules. It's up to the provider to have the conversation with the medical director about things that they think are important. We are the ones that see the patients in the field every day. It's not the docs. The docs have a lot of other things to do. And if you want to be part of driving that culture of knowledge and education, you have to also advocate for things you think are appropriate, or protocols often don't change. They just don't. And the reality is that a large number of systems across the country, the quote unquote top tier or the most engaged providers, are sitting in the room right there with the medical directors talking about changes they're going to make to protocols. It isn't just a hand-me-down from the doc. It's not. At least that's been my experience and my 20 years of doing this. I've never had a medical director where I approached them about a protocol change. They didn't always agree with it. They didn't always say, yeah, we're going to change it, but they would always hear me out. Then they would look at the studies or the science that I'm bringing to the table and say, okay, yeah, no, this is worth discussion, but I've decided, oftentimes the answer is, I've decided we're not going to change it because 80% of the providers don't understand that. And thus this is the safest thing for the patient, right? But you have to understand that getting into medicine, especially extended care medicine, is you have to understand a little bit of the pathophysiology and the science of what's going on so that you can make good decisions. Because at the end of the day, most protocols have a judgment aspect at the end of their criteria, right? Mm-hmm. If you can't reach medical control, if this, that, the other, and I, this isn't really the topic of the podcast, but I have many a time called medical control and said, I want to use this medication for this activity. It's not in our protocols. Here's why. Here's the science, or here's what I understand in the latest math on this. The most recent one's been ketamine for seizures, right? I have called doctors and said, hey, I got somebody in status. The benzos aren't working. I'd like to use ketamine for this. And they give them the green light. But I wouldn't be able to have that conversation if I hadn't stayed on top of the science and understood what's been going on in the world of research and understanding around ketamine's implications to seizure patients.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I think you hit on something. I was listening to another podcast just the other day, going to DD, I don't know. But it was talking about that critical care, like a lot of this stuff on the test, like having to memorize the numbers, the thing, like most of that is highly overrated. Very little of your time will be spent doing so much of this other stuff. It's the thinking part, the problem solving. And so in my brain, I was thinking, it's not really critical care, it's critical thinking care, right? You have to think through the problem and provide the necessary care, whether that's a physical action of doing a skill, intubation, IV access, whatever it is, or as you've pointed out, understanding the pathophysiology of, this is what I believe is going on with the patient. This is what I anticipate is going to be coming up if we don't intervene now with whatever, and then being able to make those things. And I think that critical care mindset of having the advanced knowledge and understanding of the problem that's going on with the patient, even more important in the wilderness and austere environment, right? Because you're already at that deficit of, I don't have the ambulance or the helicopter or the ER room with all of the things, with the full suite of tools and medications. And when Mike and I talked about this, we're always talking about no kidding, true austere backcountry things. Like, you're working out of a backpack and there's only so much you can carry in. And you may have, depending on your work, a limited pharmacology suite to work from. And so you, as a provider, whether you're an EMT or a paramedic, you need to understand what those medications are doing, what they're doing now for your patient, and what some long-term, maybe adverse or benefits of those medications will also be. You can't just start slinging things that you think are relatively benign and not think about what's going to happen if this is still a problem 6 hours from now. Because maybe you've shot your load, you don't have it, or you didn't plan accordingly, your logistics, like we've talked about before, and now you're out, and now you don't know what to do. So it's the critical thinking piece. And the only way you're going to be good at that critical thinking piece is if you stay up on all your pathophysiology and the current science and the knowledge that's coming out. The ketamine with seizures is a great one. Hey, I've only got this much of my benzos. I've gone through it. They're still hitting seizures. Is there anything else I can do? And if you weren't up on the new stuff with ketamine, you wouldn't even think to call med control if it's outside your protocol. And I don't know if no one local, I think, is using ketamine based on protocol for seizures yet. But a lot of people are now starting to call their med control and say, hey, doc, this is what we got going on. This is what I would like to do. And then I haven't heard of anybody being denied yet because the physicians are getting well schooled up on this as well. But like you say, if you're not up on all that, how are you going to know? And that's a key aspect, especially when you work in that austere environment. I've got limited resources. And depending on what your local protocol, your medical director allows, you get to that point of, I'm outside of communications range. I can't talk to anybody. So now I have to use my provider big brain and apply the knowledge and experience that I have to make the best case justification for why I'm about to do procedure X or administer whatever med. And if you don't stay up on all that, you simply can't do that. You're stuck living in 1985.
Yep. Yeah.
Morphine for chest pain. Cool. All right, guys. Now what? I don't know.
And that, so that leads to, we've long advocated that there's no such thing as wilderness medicine. There's only medicine in the wilderness. The difference being it's extended care. You're with the patients longer. That also means, we've talked about this before. We're getting to the point in the podcast where I say, yeah, we talked about this before quite often.
Yeah, we're 2.5 years in.
Yeah, man. This is where it bleeds a little bit into nursing care. One of the things that took away recently from a program I attended, it was full disclosure, shout out, past 24, blew my mind. I've said this before too, but it was way better than I was. But I attended a 2-day course there. And one of the things that was said really landed with me, right? At some point, when you advance in your medicine journey, you start only caring not only about what you put into the patient, but what comes out, namely urine output, and understanding that urine output is a direct measure of kidney function and the biological function going on within your patient. And it gives you a measurement of how sick they are and being able to measure ins and outs and knowing how much fluid gone in and how much urine has come out. And that actually becomes very important. And it made me think about it because there've been many a time where Sean and I have been with people for an extended period of time, we're measuring urine output. And it didn't occur to me that it isn't something that a lot of people do, but if you work in a 911 system or you're not with a patient for a long period of time, that is really not a thing we talk about. And I did not intend to go into specific skill sets people should acquire, but it is an example of extended care requires caring about more than just the goes in says, but the goes out says. You have to care about urine output. It is a thing.
You drop 2 liters into a patient and 6 hours later, nothing's come out. That should be concerning.
It is, but that is an example of where understanding the science of what's going on in the body becomes pretty important. I also did want to mention that this may seem a little daunting, and there's a lot of resources out there. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about how to do this, but it is not just medicine. And I've come up with two particular things. It's not just medicine that you have to focus on. There are two other key, I'll call it traits, that you have to develop. One, shout out to the world's okayest paramedic. He's forced me to get better at this. You have to be able to read scientific research paper. You have to be able to draw. Now, I will fully admit, I do not spend a lot of time reading papers. I just don't have the kind of time in my life. But I do consume a lot of content and get inquisitive and get curious about things that are said. And in the era of the internet, and even in the last 10 years, the amount of content that is put out now, it's almost inexcusable to say, oh, I didn't know about X, Y, or Z. Man, it's out there. You do not have to read all the papers yourself. But I am learning that there's a ton of dogma, especially pre-hospital medicine. What was the one I heard the other day? Somebody made a comment about bolusing bicarb is about useless, and you have to understand what's actually going on. But it led me down a rabbit hole. And if I hadn't spent the time in the last 6 months learning how to read papers, would not have been nearly as useful. There's a lot of content in papers. Hell, Sean, when we were together 2 weeks ago on duty, I was sitting there reading a paper, right? And
oh, yeah.
You disagreed with me on a number of things inside the paper, but it has actually broadened my knowledge base quite a bit by actually consuming the content and then taking the time to say, okay, I want to actually go read. At least the most studies have the overview and the outcomes pieces that you need to consume. Some of the in-depth scientific stuff gets a little tedious sometimes, depending on who's writing the paper. But I have personally developed a habit, if you will, of understanding the methodology, right? The methodology of the research or the methodology of the study gives you a lot of insight as to whether or not it is large scale applicable or not. And there's a lot of things that are said, especially in pre-hospital medicine. Oh, there was this one study out of such and such that did blah, 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 or found that blah, blah, blah. And if you stop at that level, right? So-and-so told me about a study or I heard about this thing, even if you're quote unquote staying on top of things. If you don't go look at the study, you may not realize that study had 17 participants in an in-hospital program. And the authors will typically say, this was a small-scale study. This is not directionally necessary, or this is not necessarily directional. It was a small bit of information that we gathered. The more studies, more research is needed. That is a common term that is used. More research, more evaluation is needed. But oftentimes I'm finding in the pre-hospital world, we're picking up a lot of these things and saying, oh, there was this paper out of Houston, this paper out of Nevada that says X, Y, and Z. But it isn't until I take the time to go dig into it and I go, wait a minute. This one study had 17 patients and it was all like, they eliminated so many people from the study that you can almost draw a conclusion that they knew what they wanted the answer to be beforehand. And
yeah,
I'm not saying that scientists do that. I'm not saying that doctors do that. I'm just saying that it happens organically when you end up omitting so many people from studies. And this isn't just my pre-hospital world. I've talked about this a little bit before. My mother had a pretty significant MI last year. And when I was at the hospital, she was approached by third or fourth year resident that was doing a study on a particular medication that is used for diabetes. And they asked her to be part of the study to determine if this medication had any positive impact on people post myocardial infarction. And that was one of the first papers where I was like, hey, I'm going to actually go read what they're trying to achieve here. I went and found the scientific premise for the study, but it led me to realize that they were omitting. So like my mom was only something like 12% of the total context they had that was considered qualified for the evaluation. And if we use just the studies to determine how we're going to do pre-hospital care, sometimes the volume isn't there. The implications aren't there, right? You mentioned the backboard thing earlier. It's one doc that had a premise that if moving your spine around is bad, then we should probably not move spines around. And that became dogma for 30 years around how we handle trauma patients. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. I've been talking for almost 25 minutes, give or take. Clearly, I feel passionate about this, and it's probably something worth being passionate about. This is the difference between being an engaged provider. Here's a stump simple example. It's not even necessarily the science or the biology or the pathophysiology. It's quite frankly, do you even know how the EMS system works? The number of people I've interacted with that don't completely understand how medical direction is structured and how state laws are formulated and how protocols end up coming into being and understanding the principle that you're practicing under a doctor's license and it is up to that doctor to give you approval to do these things. It's surprising to me how many people don't really understand that. And it's part of our job to understand how the EMS system functions. And that's not something you get taught in EMT school. It's just not. I think it gets talked about for what, 7 seconds? At least back when I did it. That was a long time. So, all right, Sean, I've got a list of things here, but let's start with stuff off the top of your mind. What resources do you use to stay abreast of the world and what's going on and quote unquote forward leaning edge of pre-hospital medicine, how it's going?
I think one of the best ways to do it, it always starts me off with podcasts. I don't listen to anything but basically emergency medicine podcasts. I'm that nerd.
You are a nerd.
I don't listen to Joe Rogan. I don't listen to anybody else. Yeah, I couldn't even tell you another podcast that's out there. So I listen to a lot of podcasts, and a lot of them I listen to, or at least there's two or three that are very, two of them are very specifically discussing papers and research.
What are they?
In emergency medicine. The Recess Room, which is...
Yep, that's on my list.
Group of British docs. And those guys are great because they always have their papers of the month or papers of the week, whatever it is. And they talk about some of the latest research. And then if there's something in there, because again, for them, it's emergency medicine. And they discuss pre-hospital and hospital-based, but a lot of it is hospital-based. And so some of the things, you know, like I think they just did one on MRI scans for first-time seizures. Like, neat, but I'm not going to go do any deep dive research on it. But then they looked at one talking about some pre-oxygenation practices for RSI. That one, as a pre-hospital provider, interests me. And so that gives me an indication, okay, what's the name of that paper? Let's go look at that and do a little more research on that. Same with getting things like hearing about ketamine and seizures, a lot of other stuff. The other one is the EMS Lighthouse Project, which is, I believe, Dr. Jeff Jarvis. And I believe that's now under the Flight Bridge umbrella.
I believe it is as well. I listen to that one too.
But he is a self-admitted research nerd. He loves the science and the data part of the research. And he will break it down for us meatheads about why that study was more valid or not based on, like Mike mentioned, the research methodology and all the other stuff that goes into it. Again, he's focused very much on a lot of pre-hospital stuff just because he's an active medical director involved with EMS. So a lot of his stuff is very applicable to what we do. So he's always a good start point.
Mm-hmm.
World's Okayest Medic, Carrencio. He does a lot of talking about, hey, here's this new thing that came out, and he'll do a little bit of research on it. And he's great because he always puts up the reference. He'll put up the PMID numbers of the papers that he finds. So mm-hmm. if you want to go mm-hmm. and look at it yourself, great resource. And then there's some other ones that are really more militarily based, the Prolonged Field Care podcast. It's geared toward soft medics, but the one reason I keep listening to them is, I mean, it's called the Prolonged Field Care podcast. And so many of the things, not necessarily applicable anymore to us civilian EMS providers, but some of the science and the research behind why the military is changing some of its doctrine and we'll call it protocol on how they do certain prolonged care situations.
I've learned a lot about sometimes trauma beneficial. Care.
Oh yeah, that's the specialty of all military medicine. But
yep.
So listening to them, you might hear about maintaining care for TBI patients for prolonged time. What can we do for TBI in these remote settings? And the answer is not a lot, but can learn some things that maybe you have access to, maybe you don't, things to consider, things just to educate your brain so that it's, this is what I'm suspecting. I should most definitely start to pay attention because I know I've only got this, maybe this 4-hour window where I can really get them out and affect good outcomes. Whereas after that, it's okay. Basically comes down to supporting the ABCs, doing what you can, depending on what your pharmacology suite is, to administer certain meds. And then that's it, right? I can't do anything else. So I just got to hold on to them until I can evacuate. But that gives you some baseline knowledge to do some more research and say, hey, has there been any research on this in the pre-hospital setting? What in the civilian side are we looking at with TBI care pre-hospitally? Not a lot out there on that. That's definitely a get them to the doctor place. They got to get scans and figure out what the problem is. Agreed. But things like not putting them in C colors because that helps to increase ICP.
ICP.
Possible. Yep. And so why do something to increase ICP for somebody that's probably already got an increased ICP? Any number of things. Yeah. Those are probably my biggest ones. I got to be honest, like publication-wise, pre-hospital medicine, there is pretty much jack and shit out there that is worth reading and looking at anymore. I'm not going to read the New England Medical Journal or New England Journal of Medicine or whatever it is, right? They publish a lot of great papers, but that's, I'm not going to subscribe to that and read through it, right? It's just not going to happen. So really, for me, it's podcasts or attending conferences like FAST, and you hear about somebody, a presenter will talk about some recent research and this is what they found, or this is where science is going, and then going, oh, interesting, taking some notes, and then start doing a little deep dive on your own.
Yeah.
That's much it.
I got a couple things about conferences, but first I've got a few additional podcasts that I like. So we've mentioned The Recess Room, EMS Lighthouse Project, MCRIT, I don't think we've talked about yet.
Yeah, MCRIT, good. Oh, Heavy Lies the Helmet. Goddamn, yeah, there's so many.
Yep. So MCRIT, that one is paid now.
Yeah.
But Scott Weingart puts a lot of time, energy, and effort into it, and it's worth, I subscribe. It's worth it to me. See, you mentioned Heavy Lies the Helmet. That's another great one.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of Heavy Lies the Helmet.
The Flight Bridge podcast, they put out some really good stuff. There's a lot of them. I mean, holy crap.
So I like the MCHD paramedic podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those guys are great.
Coffee Break Hems is another good one.
Yep.
And I will put all these in the notes as well. We mentioned The Recess Room, The EMS Show. I think that's Mike Verchest. And a couple others. I like that one. I've actually found a lot of good information recently from Alert.
Yeah. Mixed on that one.
That's the thing I like about Alert Medic one is it's from a biomedic natural run response perspective.
Yeah. No, and it's not that it's a bad show. It's just, I don't know. I don't always feel the vibe from them. They seem like good, smart dudes. And the episodes that I do listen to are always very good. Just that isn't high on my go-to list right now, but I am a subscriber. I do listen to it. So
the MCHD podcast.
Yeah. We mentioned that one.
Did we?
Shit.
EMS 2020. Can't believe we haven't mentioned them yet.
Yeah, I don't listen to them anymore.
All right.
Just kidding.
I do. Just kidding. I like the fact that they do call reviews. They do. I like the fact that they review the call soup to nuts, and then they talk about the other aspect.
Yeah.
We're all over the place today. So those are some of the big ones. If I come up with others, I'll go look at my podcast consumption stream.
I'll just toss out just two more. So the CoRM, the College of Remote and Offshore Medicine, so that one doesn't necessarily give you a lot like of research related stuff necessarily, But if you're interested in that remote and wilderness medicine, they've got some good episodes. And then the Rebel EM, which is another thing. So the Rebel Cast, that's again another good one. And that's pretty much most of my shit.
All right. I also wanted to mention there are some Instagram resources or social media resources. The Pre-Hospitalist, who has a lot of great content.
Yeah, she's really good.
She's also pretty awesome as a person in general. EMS 2020, or excuse me, not EMS 2020. The World's Okayest Paramedic. There's all kinds of good stuff in there.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
He really is.
For Instagram-y stuff, Nurse Gwenny.
Nurse Gwenny.
I love me some Gwenny. She is amazing, and she puts out some really good stuff. And
she does.
For those that don't know, she's currently works as a flight nurse. She puts out some really good content, and it's all, again, pre-hospital-based stuff. Heavy critical care bent because she's a flight nurse, but a lot of it is very applicable to just normal ground transport EMS folks. Yeah, but she's a good one too.
Okay, and then finally, I wanted to mention more and more conferences are offering an option to attend remotely or consume the content after the fact. And I think that's something people should take advantage of. In person is still the best, in my opinion. There's nothing like being in the room, but traveling and cost prohibitive aspects of going to conferences on a regular basis can get pretty quick. Plus, it's time away from work. Take advantage of those online resources that are available. And then there's a number of state agency or state EMS conferences that they focus typically on 911 response. Those are all great conferences as well. Virginia has historically had one of the bigger ones that's gone by the wayside. And then finally, did want to mention that part of being a pre-hospital provider and being a competent pre-hospital provider also means that you have a certain skill set in leadership and management. And I haven't identified any resources per se. I could probably dig some up later if anybody sends us a note. At the end of the day, what we're really doing is mixing chaos with science, right? With biology. And if you can't lead through that, and honestly, my education in becoming a leader and my background in management and managing situations has helped me a lot, because at the end of the day, you have to make decisions about what comes first, second, and third, and how to manage all the external pieces of the puzzle. Because you can be super awesome at medicine, but if it turns out you can't talk to anybody, or you can't ask somebody to do something for you, or you are unable to properly wrangle chaos into some sort of order, it just makes doing everything else a lot harder. So I didn't want to belabor that point. I don't want to spend a lot of time yapping about it, but I think it's important for people to understand that leadership is an aspect, especially for the younger paramedics out there. You're going to be looked at as the HMFIC, so to speak. You're going to be looked at as the guy that knows more than other people on a scene. And you need to, this isn't a 10-year study in how to be an executive leader, but it is a little bit of, you need to have a little bit of skill set in decision-making and task management to drive a scene appropriately and get the patient ultimately the care they need and to the destination they deserve for the injuries they've sustained or the medical problem they're experiencing.
Yeah. And so I'm going to jump on this one. This leadership aspect, this goes across the levels. I don't care who you are, but this is very important in that wilderness and austere setting, because you might be the lone responder that first shows up, and you might be, you're an EMT. You're a good EMT. You study, you try to stay up to date. You're proficient in all your skills, your assessments. When you show up on that scene and that injured person that's in the middle of some remote area, whether that's whatever, it doesn't matter. They're looking to you to solve the problem, right? You are there. You're literally Iron Man who just landed, and it's like, okay, cool. The help is here. We're all good now. And if you were, oh, hell, ABC seems safe, man. I don't know, right? You need to have that leadership and that presence, even if it's just for a bit. And just for a bit in this context could be an hour or so, to calm your patient, calm their family and friends, and start making decisions and making those radio calls of additional resources that you think you're going to need. Like, if the route you took to get to the patient is probably going to be the route you take back, what are you going to need? Do we need to put them in a Stokes? Do we have to carry them? Is there going to be a technical aspect to this? Do we need ropes for anything? Maybe just a little bit of safety for some fall avoidance kind of stuff? Or we're going to have to do full-on lowers or raises? Does this patient look like they're a priority and we need a helicopter? Whatever it might be, you have to be able to display that initial bit of leadership to get those pieces moving, because you can't wait in the austere environment, right? You can't wait. We have, Mike and I work with a lot of great young EMTs, and they're all getting much better the longer they've been doing this. So experience does count. But if you wait the hour and a half before we show up, man, that's an hour and a half wasted when other resources could already be on the way with us. So that leadership is important. And I will say, you're not going to become a good leader by reading a book. Most of them are just full of cliche and mindless bullshit that everybody else regurgitates in a different manner. I don't care who wrote it, Fortune 500 dude, another goddamn SEAL writes a book, whatever it is. And you can get some ideas, but you've got to get out there and you've got to do it. And I would say this falls into the training paradigm. Whoever your leaders are in your training environment need to be forcing you to step up and take those roles and learn these things. And the more you practice them and learn them in a training environment, then when the shit really matters, at least you've got a baseline to fall to and you're not just guessing at it for your first time. And that's my rant.
Now, I think with that, man, I'm gonna say we done nailed it, because you done nailed it. I will put links to the podcast we mentioned into the show notes. And with that, any final thoughts, Sean?
I think just to sum it up, and goddamn, this is the same summary we give to probably half of our episodes. Know your shit. Be proficient in your skills, your patho-phys. Know your meds if you're carrying meds. Train. Not just train necessarily in the environment you function in, but seek additional training. And not just, like Mike mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, of your baseline CE level stuff. Like, air goes in and out. Well, right. Like,
blood goes running around too. I don't know if you knew that.
It does. Yeah. Start learning more than the air needs to go in and out and blood needs to stay in the body stuff. Challenge yourself. Take classes. There are a lot of online training programs that are out there. Depending on your level, some are more difficult than others. Some are more applicable than others. But seek the training. Train hard. Practice your leadership. When you're doing a training event and you've got the opportunity to be the leader at something, do it. I don't care if you feel embarrassed or you screw it all up at that moment. It's better for you to start getting some experience now than to wait until, oh shit, I'm now that person and you've never done any of it before. So that's it.
Challenge yourself.
Know your shit.
Know your
Learn
shit.
Some shit. Be a good leader. You got to set the example, right? Got to be the duck. Be the duck.
All right. Hitting the stop button.
If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.